So what was the process by which you became minister?
Yeah. So both Robert Mast and Phil Miller, who were co-pastoring at the time, had health problems that had somewhat incapacitated them, or at least they were less able to carry out their, mm-hmm. their pastoral duties. Robert's was more of a mental, emotional. Brother Phil's was more of a, it was a heart condition, I think, at that time. I think Robert came to three of us, Chester Mast, Merlin Miller, and myself.
What year would that have been?
That would have been like 1988, I think. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I have that. And asked whether we would be worship leaders and assist with conducting the Sunday service as a way of taking maybe some of the load off of Phil and Robert. And then as time went on, I think, and that may have even included Robert taking some therapy out of town at that point. I mean, do you remember any of that, Kelly?
Yeah, the year Brenda and Matt got married, because he was supposed to officiate their wedding.
You're right about
like
that.
3 weeks before, he backed out of it because of that.
Yeah.
And that's when he went away for a while, you know, for some healing. And
is that Harrisonburg?
I don't know where he went.
I think he went to Phil Haven, which was a facility near Hershey, Pennsylvania. Yeah, I think that's right. At any rate, what even is a little foggy to me is then, so at some point, the need for one of us to be assistant pastor, you know, duties more than just being an occasional worship leader. And honestly, I don't know exactly how I came to be called to do that. I believe even John Keffer questioned that process right there. By the way, the more I got to know your dad, the more I appreciated him. And I think, Dale said, the Keffers say things that other people are thinking, right? but seriously, I mean, Johnny Keffer would ask the questions that needed to be asked. Mm-hmm. And it was certainly a legitimate question. Obviously, if I can't even remember for sure how that happened. I mean, you know, Chester and Merlin were both very capable guys too. So anyway, I can't even tell you exactly how that happened, but I do know at some point then, you know, my name was submitted to the congregation for a vote. And that was not as lead pastor. I was an assistant pastor, and the first year, 1989, with Robert Mast, and then the second year with Adona Nisley, who was called for to be an interim pastor.
I never met him. How long was he here?
Well, he was in the Tabler area for, I don't know, maybe 5 years or so, but really only under assignment at Mount Pleasant for just over a year. And then he went to Deep Creek and assumed responsibility for pastoring Deep Creek. So then...
What were they doing in the area? Was he here to fill the assignment?
No, I think he was, you know, I don't know if it was a search committee or a leadership council or who it was exactly that had invited Adona and Mary to come here to be pastor and to also mentor this young
He'd been
assistant.
A pastor before?
Oh, yes. In fact, he was at Christiansburg, you know, near Tech. for, I don't know how long, but a number of years prior to being here. And he had had other pastorates as well, including Puerto Rico, where he spent like 20 plus years of his life, something like that. Yeah.
So you were an assistant for a year for 88 or 89, and then Donna came in 90?
Right.
And you were mentor to pastor then, but Robert and Phil were both out of the...
That's right. At that point, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it was you and Adana.
Right.
For
right.
a year. And right. then you were on your own. Is that when Keith came in, or did they do something different?
Well, it wasn't quite that quick. So Adana was kind enough to stay the month of January.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a January course, and it was a short seminary course at AMBS, Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary in Goshen, Indiana. And so Adona stayed, you know, while I completed that, and then basically went on the Deep Creek as I became pastor then in, you know, February 91. Mm-hmm. Stayed with my cousin Roy Berge while I was out there, who lived at that time in Goshen. No, actually, lived in Shipshewana, Indiana. You know where that is?
Mm-mm.
Amish country.
I'm reading about these places, but I don't know where they are until 2 weekends ago. We went to Pennsylvania just to see where some of these places were located, so I could get a feel of what I'm reading about and writing about.
Springs, Pennsylvania, and Meckville.
I think I saw some pictures. But go ahead, were you going to ask me?
Okay, then. So after you were pastor, now, when he left Deep Creek, is that when they closed Deep Creek?
It wasn't long after that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the exact timeline, but it would not have been long after that.
Was Mount Pleasant still using the bishop, preacher, deacon hierarchy then?
Yes, right. Although we had deacons and deaconess, which probably wouldn't be a popular way to refer to them these days, but female deacons. And the deacons in that, in my memory, and during the time we're talking about, were not ordained.
Mm.
Like, my dad was ordained as a deacon, you know, for that.
No, it was an important position.
That's right. It was, I mean, still important, but it in that hierarchy you talked about, a deacon was kind of like vice president or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So after he left, does that when
Keith?
Yeah.
Because you had asked about Keith earlier.
Is that when he joined the ministry team, or
wasn't it Merlin first?
Oh,
didn't Merlin? I served about 4 years with Merlin, about 4 years with Keith. Now, okay. Which was...
You'd probably be right.
I'm actually not absolutely sure. I should know that. So Merlin and Linda launched that, what did they call the
Dove.
Church plant? Dove, thank you. Dove Christian Fellowship, right.
What was that? I don't know anything about that.
Them and Daniel and Dorcas started a church.
I don't know, it had a brief, healthy period, I guess, but...
Where did they meet?
The school.
Mm.
At one point, there was at the school,
right.
The fellowship hall,
right.
Or the social hall.
And it was called Dove?
I think it was Dove Christian Fellowship,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. I think they also met at on Johnstown Road, Apostles Lutheran, for a short time as well.
Okay.
Sorry, got you off track.
No, you're filling in where my memory fails.
Well, what year did you decide to leave and go back to the farm? What year was that?
Oh, that was, well, it's when I actually left and when I decided to leave. Separated by a little bit there, but basically 2005. So my last day as pastor at Mount Pleasant would have been December 31st, 2006.
Were there any reasons other than going back to Save the Farm that motivated you to do it?
Yeah, it was a combination. I'll only be in Glory Land or some time that I'll know if all of this was legitimate and I made the best decisions. But as I believe you and I have talked about before, but you know, my parents were in a pretty critical situation at that point. They really did not have much income. They were counting on rental income from the farm property that they owned, and the farm was failing. So anyway, so that was certainly a driver, just that sort of almost crisis situation. But decision of the congregation with a lot of reluctance about moving the church to the school and combining the two, as I understand right now, much better than I did back then, but that was a real disappointment to me. We came out with meaning those of us who favored that move, a very slight majority. It was like 54% or something like that, which is not the way you lead a unified church. You know, okay, we're going to do this, and 46% of us don't want to do this. So, anyway, we had, well, you didn't ask this, so I won't elaborate on this, but just took a number of steps trying to restore trust and goodwill, you know, within the congregation. I think everyone on the leadership council, including myself, went to see personally, face to face, with some of the people who opposed that move, and you know, tried to make amends, I guess, where it was necessary and that kind of thing. So anyway, I always felt very grateful that the church didn't split over that. That seemed to me to be a good thing.
I had no idea there was anything like that going on.
But I split, you know. I mean, you know, it was hard for me then to embrace any kind of a vision or energy for going on with leading the church. I thought maybe they were tired of me and you know, I didn't have much of a vision for the future. That because I just really felt that the gift of the property and the ceaseless problem of jet noise, current location of the church, and so on. And of course, different people had different opinions about that. So I concluded that the need on the one hand of my parents and the sort of being kind of out of energy or out of vision as far as the church is concerned, that's what took me there.
So that was in 2005?
Well, I continued through the 2006 year.
Okay. Then, and Keith was there then. Did Sam come in immediately after you left, or was that at some later? And what was the process by which they hired Sam?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how much of this I want to go into print, because, you know, some of this is broadly known and some is not.
Well, I can't promise you what I will or will not print, so if you don't want me to, don't tell me.
Yeah, okay.
But you're not the only person, because there are the first split was 12, and then the Deep Creek thing that I'm getting information from Deep Creek people about, and this one, and because the others are so ill-documented, I'm determined this one will be documented, at least from all sides.
Uh-huh.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
Yeah.
Don't tell me anything you don't want me to tell you.
Well,
I will promise not to quote you if you don't want to be quoted, but I won't promise not to put it in there if it's...
Well, I can tell you in a very basic way without, you know, some of the fine details that might implicate certain persons that as, you know, making a false move or, you know, mistake. But, so, immediately following... you know, January the 1st, 2007, you know, I was out And Mount Pleasant had agreed to call an interim pastor for a year. And that was Jim Medor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you...
Yeah.
That's when we came back.
Yeah, okay, right. So then during the time that Jim was here, the congregation formed a search committee for a longer-term pastor.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a candidate. Well, maybe several, but there was one that had attracted serious attention. You know, for better or for worse, about that time, Sam and Keith came forward with a proposal. You know, we could co-pastor here. You know, Keith had the experience of co-pastoring before, and Sam certainly was an experienced church leader and, you know, had quite a bit of pastoring experience. So my understanding is that the search committee just jumped on that. The other candidate was more or less forgotten because it's always...
Was it somebody from out of the area?
Yeah. It's always easier to go with the people you know than the people you don't know. So then they were on. A very short order. Wasn't like there was a lot of debating about that. I can't tell you how many months it was, but it wasn't a long period of time until Keith and Sam were the pastors.
Well, had Keith also been there when Jim Medor was there? Was he an assistant pastor then?
I don't know that he was assistant pastor. Now, I've got to hand it to Keith. He was a big help to me in that last year. It wasn't an official pastoral role, but, you know, he might have been, that I can recall, but, you know, he might have been chair of the church council or some kind of administrative position. Yeah, at least I don't think he had any kind of a pastoral title at that point, but maybe I'm wrong.
So he wasn't preaching then?
He might have preached occasionally.
So Sam came in 2008?
I think he was saying 7, right?
Well,
or no, the Jim Medor. That's right.
Jim Medor would have been 2007. I can't remember to the month what happened when. But
and even though I was there, what year did he leave? I can't remember.
Medor?
No, Sam.
I would say it was about 3 years that Sam continued as pastor there.
He had a 3-year contract, and it's when it came up for renewal that everything hit the fan. I say that's a bad way to put it, that the conflict came out in the open, or the folks who didn't want to renew. I don't remember if, let me tell you how I remember details.
Okay.
And if it's incorrect, I want to be corrected. As I remember, they had a vote, a written vote, to hand in by a certain deadline, whether to renew or not renew.
Okay.
And as I recall, it came out 50-50, I was split right down the middle. And Ronnie Lehman had turned his in late, and so they didn't count it, which made him so mad he never came back. And I'll have to tell you, in reading all this church history from the very beginning, and all the various splits that have come down, and the different sides of them, some are well explained, some you just have to, what was that about? You
know, yeah,
nobody
yeah,
knows.
Yeah.
Was it before that, or after that, that the bishop, or actually they call him something different now, what do they call him, advisor? No.
Overseer.
Called the mass meeting for everybody to meet at the church and have their say. Was that before the vote or after the vote?
I don't know.
Are you talking about the same time? Because it was around 2014 or 15 that they had the mass meeting, not 2000.
Well, Sam would have been there for longer than 3 years then. Because he was.
Was Sam there twice?
No. Well, he might have been renewed, but there was no interim. Sam was there, he was there until he wasn't there.
Well, there's a time gap then, because if Jim Medor came in for 2007, and you said he was there for how long?
I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah.
It might have extended a little bit into 2008.
Right. Then you were thinking Sam and Keith came together in 2008. So there's still a time gap there because it was around 14 or 15.
Well, maybe it was there 6 years instead of 3. Harold's memory is not like mine.
No, I don't think he was there that long. Because he was
I haven't talked to Keith, and I've talked to a couple of people on the periphery and gotten their be on it, but frankly, they're just about as fuzzy as I am, and they remember things differently. Just like one of them said, oh, no, we had the meeting, and then we voted. And then Sam was so mad, he just left. And everybody else got mad, and they left.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they remember. I said, well, no, I don't remember it that way. I remember we had the vote, and because it was 50-50, or so close to 50-50, and because they wouldn't count Ronnie Lance.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Ronnie's got a lot of my brother Gary. Bless his heart.
It's another story, but I miss seeing Ronnie. I do too. I never see him anymore. But
well, I run into him now and then. I'll meet up and talk, but he was good to have in the church.
No, but I'm not sure. I'm not coming up with anything for...
Between Jim Meadow and Sam and Keith, because Sam was there when Brent died, so I know he was there in 2013.
Okay. So well, maybe I have Sam's time just too short. That may be the problem. Because you might, before Sam left, I don't know how much of this was official, but Sam had invited Musser. He was at Huntington.
Yeah, I know the. I've heard the name.
I'm a little ashamed that
he was not overseer there, right?
No. No, in fact...
But he invited him for what?
Well, I had oversight of all the Eastern District, with the exception of Mount Pleasant, mm-hmm. during that time. And so I'm really frustrated I can't remember Musser's first name, but anyway, I'll get to that pretty soon, I guess. But he had gotten a vote of no confidence at Huntington, that was somewhat complicated, but
was the Huntington Virginia Conference?
Yeah, it was. Anyway, Sam and Musser saw very much alike on a lot of things, mm-hmm. and so even though Nevin had been in the picture earlier, I would say Nevin was kind of edged to the side. And Sam was encouraging Musser to come on, who was a very experienced pastor, but also had just lost the confidence of mm-hmm. a congregation that's sort of like our sister congregation or something like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Kelly, the mistake I've made is probably I didn't give Sam long enough there.
So he may have started earlier than, or... Not earlier.
Continued longer than what I said 3 years, mm-hmm. maybe it could have been more like 6 years, I don't know for sure.
Now, I don't remember, not sure I ever knew, did the church then vote and decide not to renew, or did he just withdraw his application to renew?
Well, I think it was the latter, I'm pretty sure. As even, I think the understanding was that both on Sam's part and the part of others, that if there had been a vote at that point, Sam wouldn't have been blessed into, at least he wouldn't have had the level of support that a pastor needs to be an effective pastor. So particularly, it was really, really hard for Bev, maybe more than Sam. I mean, you know, he moved on to things that he found fulfillment in, but Bev just really got hit in the gut.
Well, it's her church where she grew up in. She
exactly.
had roots and ties there that Sam doesn't have. There's also, I mean, even though I was sorry to see everybody leave, I really wasn't sorry to see Sam leave. He's still a friend. We still do some business together and talk occasionally. But Sam has a remarkable facility to not have a clue what somebody on the other side of the table is thinking. Sometimes his reader is just off. I've just seen it too often that he believes what he wants to believe, or is persuaded of right now, and you know, he could be in a whole room full of people who absolutely saw it the other way, and he'd never realize it.
Well, you know what I'm about to say. You can throw some darts at me too, because I certainly didn't. I mean, I made some real bloopers. But anyway, the church in Lesja, Albania, mm-hmm. and the Lesja Academic Center both just had a big celebration a month ago. 30 years celebration of the founding of the church and 10-year anniversary of the founding of the school. And there is no question but what Sam had a very pivotal, essential role in that, mm-hmm. with his evangelistic gift. So, I mean, if you want to put it in biblical terms, I think simply Sam has a gift of evangelism, but not of shepherding.
Right.
He's got tremendous energy. He's got tremendous speaking capabilities, articulate and the like. And I say this with you, you know, he was, I had my horse accident during,
mm-hmm.
and that was 2010, by the way, right? Yeah, it would have been.
I was still working for you. I think so.
Or, yeah, well, anyway, I know Sam came to see me, and he was still several times, actually, mm-hmm. in the hospital and then at home. But for the most part, mm-hmm. he was not the gentle, kind shepherd. You know, he was pounded mm-hmm. forward and always moving on to bigger and better and higher and that kind of thing.
No, different pastors or ministers or even other people in the church all have different gifts, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
My brother Dale, as much as I love him, Dale and I can talk, we grew up in the same bed for most of our lives until he left home. So we can talk about everything even if we disagree on it, and we're probably closer to each other than we are to any of the other brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and I think he's a fantastic evangelist. He'd be a horrible pastor because he has no patience with people.
Some of the same. Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, and by the way, Dale was one of my best advocates for the move of the church to the school and combining
the
two. Yeah. Yeah, he thought that was a wonderful idea, as did Leslie Francisco, who was another,
mm-hmm.
Hampton. Anyway, be that as it may. Yeah, so evangelist, yes. Pastor on the weaker side.
Now, why did so many people leave when he did? Do you have any inkling? My intention is to talk to every one of them and ask them exactly mm-hmm. that question mm-hmm. and for their insight. What did you see happen there?
I can only speak to that on behalf of a few people. Ruth Kassberg Waff was one of them, and Ruth is very deeply spiritual, deep convictions, lots of insight. But she had grown up in and later pastored, you know, a Pentecostal type church
mm-hmm.
that was much more like the cornerstone mm-hmm. churches that Sam had been mentored, I guess, in, when mm-hmm. he and Bev were younger. And so I know Ruth was, when Mount Pleasant Mennonite Church could no longer welcome Sam, she perceived that as, well, we really are on separate paths, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that made her...
Church at Lansdowne. Now, Harold Buckwalter was initially started that, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And they've had about six or seven pastors since then, including Merlin and Sam.
Yeah, probably. Right. Noah Stolzfus, yeah.
On Deep Creek, I know at one point they had quite a congregation, quite a few people over there, enough to support a congregation. When they finally closed it down, was it simply there just weren't enough people left there anymore?
I think basically, yeah. And not enough people to support or make a meaningful call to a pastor. I mean, it was down to Barbara Slaybaugh and very, very few people.
The Slaybaughs, if Amos Lehman's, Amos Lehman's had moved out.
Yeah.
When they came back, they came to Mount Pleasant. Of course, Deep Creek might not have been there anymore. I remember my dad, when I was just a boy, had heard made more on more than one occasion the comment, the only reason Deep Creek exists is because Charlie Wolfer wanted to be a preacher and they wouldn't have him in Mount Pleasant. Now, having learned more about the history, I understand that's a gross exaggeration because they did have enough people to have a church. We stopped to see Myron Hostetler and dropped some stuff off. Some of Gramps's financial papers from the 20s.
Before. So Milan is 90 now, right?
90 is one or two or three.
90, okay, okay.
Yeah, he's at least 90. And we talked a little bit, and I asked him, I said, what precipitated the break in Deep Creek, you know, the split of the church? He said, there wasn't any split. I said, come on, Milan, there was a split.
You're talking about earlier when
Cramer's time, back
yeah,
in the
yeah,
50s.
Yeah, yeah, right,
well,
right.
Actually, the late 50s, early 60s. And he said, oh, no, it was the Nike site came in, and folks who lost their farms to the Nike site moved to Amelia, and then some others went to Pentigo, but there wasn't any split.
Mm.
Yeah, that's... okay, Milan.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think there'd be a number of people who would contest that.
And it's interesting talking to different people and seeing how things affect them, like the Lehman girls. We had dinner with David Lehman and two of his sisters. They were just children.
Yeah.
They said, but it was terrible. I said, because, you know, one day we had friends, the next day we couldn't play with them anymore. They weren't at school. Mm-hmm. We couldn't see them. They were just...
This would have been which...
Amos Lehman's son.
Yeah, David, and who were the two sisters?
Wait a minute.
Who was it Ellen, two? One of them?
Or and Naomi. Naomi.
Oh, the oldest. Yeah, yeah. She who is my age, or almost. Maybe she's a little bit younger.
We went to have supper with David, and he brought the girls along, and I said, oh, by all means do. We wound up talking to the girls. They dominated the conversation. All he could say was, well, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Huh.
That was too young.
He's a pretty outspoken guy. I thought he wouldn't be at any...
Very conservative.
Like, yeah, yeah, he is.
Oh, go ahead.
In light of the fact that I worked with his dad in, you know, my teen years.
Well, he did.
Yeah, yeah, he worked for Burgess.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Years, yeah.
Mm.
What
did he do?
So he initially worked mostly on the farm. He came on board... in the 60s somewhere, mid-60s maybe, or something like that, and then rather abruptly decided to move to the most northern, coldest spot in the U.S. What's the name of the place in Minnesota? It's up there on Lake Superior.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, they were telling us that they had moved in.
Yeah, and of course he had fed my ear a lot of stuff that especially as a teenager, I didn't want to hear. In addition to that, I had been all excited about going off to college. And boom, right when I was getting ready to go to college, Dad's right-hand man was gone. And so I went with a lot of feeling of just being troubled for my dad, knowing that, you know, my younger brothers weren't really old enough yet to pick up the strings, and anyway, that really doesn't have much to do with David, but Amos can be pretty hard to get along with.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I only knew
beautiful singer, yeah, and had a lot of commendable qualities, but he's pretty judgmental, you know.
Fairly conservative too, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, very, very much so, yeah.
I know, I asked David, I said, as conservative as your dad was, why didn't he go along with the Cramer bunch? He said he wasn't really sure because he was too young. Interestingly enough, David said that his dad was never comfortable or happy in any community they lived in, including this one in Deep Creek, except for the one in, was it Wisconsin or Minnesota, wherever they were. So there he found a home.
Hmm. That's interesting.
And stayed there until they were not able to take care of themselves anymore and were going to go to an old folks' home, and went to one up close to David so he could keep an eye on him.
In Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's it's probably a very accurate statement. And I mean, I believe David would know maybe better than any of us, but...
I think it's pretty, like I said, he just always felt like he just didn't belong until he got there.
Mm-hmm. Well, he had a, yeah, he used to, he was quoting somebody, but this was definitely his mentality. He saw kind of a class structure between Warwick River, Mount Pleasant, and Deep Creek. And, you know, he had come from Warwick River, and he said the way he saw it was that Warwick River looked down on Mount Pleasant, Mount Pleasant looked down on Deep Creek, and Deep Creek looked down. Yeah, I heard him say that.
There's a lot of truth in that, though. At least in my growing up, that was
the impression you got from
kind of universal. When I was a teenager, the teenagers in Warwick River dressed nicer, all went to college. In Mount Pleasant, they had fast cars and weren't going to college.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't dress as nice.
Well,
in Deep Creek, they were just swamp people. But in reading all the history, it's a lot easier for me now to understand where the ordinance and the rules and regulations come in,
mm-hmm.
and how they fit, and how it's almost impossible to keep that balance between the rules and the mission, the pietism and the living it every day.
I remember very distinctly having this conversation with Pete Mast and his wife,
Virginia.
Kim, thank you. Thank you. It took me a moment. Thank you. You know, Pete had grown up in the Beachy Church.
Mm-hmm.
So Pete was asking questions, and this is when they were seeking membership, mm-hmm. at Mount Pleasant. Pete was asking questions about this whole thing of, the ban or shunning. So basically it's just a difference of, I mean, it goes way, way back. It basically caused a split between the Amish and the Mennonites, but it's an interpretation of 1 Corinthians 11, when the Apostle Paul talked about with such a one, someone who's, mm-hmm. who's sinned or left the fold, with such a one you are not to eat. Mennonites interpreted that as not to eat of the Lord's Supper, not communion, but Amish carried that all the way into the family, and you turned your back on even a brother or a child.
Or a husband or a wife.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think that whole thing of, in the Anabaptist tradition, we've always wrestled with that disciplinary, you know. I was too obsessed with it at one time. Straighten up everybody else, you know, and maybe I was getting the speck out of, trying to get the speck out of their eye and rather than dealing with the plank in my own.
Well, you know, I've read several histories of the Anabaptists in Europe and all over the place over the past year, and I didn't realize until then that our Mennonite background, who came out of Pennsylvania, all came from Switzerland and weren't called Mennonite. They called themselves the Swiss Brethren until they got to Pennsylvania. And then the Mennonites, the name really originated from the Netherlands bunch that came from Philip Ob. And then when he left, Menno Simons kind of began writing and teaching and leading, and they just acquired the Mennonite name from there. And they were the first bunch that got to Germantown, came from the Netherlands. And so when the Mennonites came from Switzerland shortly thereafter, the English thought they were all the same bunch, so they called them all Mennonites. But the Swiss bunch didn't call themselves Mennonites.
Yeah, they were the Swiss Brethren.
Were the Swiss Brethren. And in fact, I just finished an Amish history that makes more sense to me than anything I've read about the split. And that was that the Swiss Brethren, you know, after the 1525 blow-up in Zurich, that between the Reformed Church and the New Anabaptist.
Mm-hmm. Calvin and... Mm-hmm.
Right, that... This repression actually worked, and they got rid of the Anabaptists. There might have been thousands of them who were saved and made a commitment, but they backed down real quick as soon as the pressure came on. They either got killed or they backed down and joined or stayed in the Reformed Church because they were already there. And some of them managed to survive in Bern, Switzerland, in the Inn Valley. And then it was 60 or 70 years later. The Amish Mennonite split came. Well,
right.
Late 1500s.
Yeah, right.
That this actually was not from that same bunch. This was a guy named Mueller who had been preaching around the Inn Valley He wasn't preaching in the Swiss Brethren group. He was preaching the outlying areas and brought a bunch of new people into the church.
Okay.
And one of his, which makes sense to me, is look at the last names. The last names of the folks from the Amish church are different from those who came from the Mennonite church.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, they just are. Hostetler, Wanger, Berge, all those. And Berge might be one of the Emmentaler names. But that what really happened was is that they were trying to find unity. And it wasn't a matter that he broke away from them. They were never together.
Hmm.
And he was trying to bring them into unity.
Okay.
But Jacob Amon was actually a very young convert. Well, he wasn't so young. He was in his 40s, I believe. But he had not been an Anabaptist for a very long time. He went very quickly from a convert to a deacon to a preacher to a bishop.
Okay.
It was in a matter of years.
Uh-huh.
And so when he came around and started preaching this stuff with his people, at some risk, because there was a price on his head, they wanted to get rid of him. The Swiss, even in the area where the Mennonites were tolerated, because they'd learned to get along.
Reese,
who was the old guy, and here comes this upstart telling us what to do. And the three main things he had against them were the thing on the ban. But the Swiss Brethren had never signed or accepted the Dordrecht Confession. And that's where it comes from, is in the Dordrecht Confession. All the other, the Mennonites and the people in the Netherlands had, and some in Germany, and this new group that was founding accepted not the Swiss Mennonites. They hadn't, because they didn't like the band.
Yeah.
And so he was after them for that, and after them because Riest and the Swiss Mennonites had what they called, well, they were friends. They were Swiss who were not Anabaptist, but they sympathized with them, and they would help them out. They'd protect them. They'd not enforce the rules when they came out from on high. Hey, you got to evict all these guys. Well, no, we're their friends. And so, what do they call them? I forget the name now, but basically, and he would give blessings to them for helping the Mennonites. And Amon was sort of, no, you're either for us or against us. You can't beatify them and make them think they may get into heaven, because they are not getting into heaven, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there was a lady in the Swiss Mennonite church who had a habit of lying and getting by with it, and they wouldn't put her under the ban. And, you know, she was, oh, I'm so sorry, forgive me. And that would be it, okay. And they were easier to get along with, like if you were Mennonite and you decided in order to make it, I got to get the kid baptized, but it doesn't mean anything if we don't believe that anyway.
Uh-huh.
But it makes everybody else happy, fine, we'll do it. And so they had learned to survive that's last 50 years by doing things. These new converts with the zeal of a new convert.
Yeah, they were rocking the boat.
They were, you know, and so they just couldn't get together. And then after they mutually agreed that this isn't happening, three different times over the next 20 years, they came back to the Swiss Brethren to say, can we work this out and be one body?
And then, over what period of time?
It's about 20 years.
Okay.
Three times after that, they would come back to them, and the Swiss Brethren, not interested in talking.
Huh.
You made your bed, lay in it.
You know, you've never met John Ruth, have you?
No, I've seen the name, though. But
yeah, if John was sitting here right now, the two of you would be going deeper and deeper.
I'd be listening.
I think you have one of his books. That name sounds familiar, but...
Well, yeah, so he was Rose's pastor at one time.
Mm.
Had a PhD, taught at mostly Eastern College, was Eastern Baptist in Philadelphia at one time, but has done a zillion trips. He's 90 couple years old now, but he'd done a zillion trips to Germany and Switzerland and the Netherlands, and pretty much a foremost... expert, I guess, on Anabaptist history. Leon Yoder said, you know, Leon lived in Florida a few years. He said, you know, I heard this guy down in Florida, John Ruth. He said, I wish we could have him. This is when I was pastor. I wish we could have him up at Mount Pleasant sometime. I said, man, I'd love that. Well, Rose really shot that down real quick.
Why?
Well, I think she just knew that. This is my guess anyway. I don't know if she ever really elaborated, but she knew that John knew her parents very well, and that probably the more your family would get some kind of report, favorable or unfavorable. John had, he showed me these files, but he had, you know, note cards in like a huge file cabinet, just endless ones. And I'm not sure what, if you have one of his books or not. He's written some small pieces and also some very extensive ones. Well, he did a major history on Lancaster County and the different...
That's it?
That's the one you have.
That's
yeah.
a big book, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, yeah, yeah. right.
Small print.
Just just completed that, I don't know, I'm saying maybe 10 years ago, something like that. Is that something?
It might not be the one I've got then, because the one I've got is older, much older. Because I've got one, well, I've got two on the history of Lancaster County and one on the history of Franconia. Anytime I say history on a conference, I buy it.
Uh-huh.
No matter if I've never
yeah,
heard
yeah,
of it or
yeah.
a church, you know.
you know, Franconia Conference has a new name now.
Mosaic yeah,
Conference.
Because they rejoined from that split 100 years ago.
Oh, the General Conference and the...
No, the Franconian split into the Franconia Conference and the Eastern Conference, I believe it was.
Yeah, but Eastern Conference was with the General Conference.
Mm-hmm. But Eastern and Franconia have merged now.
Yeah, yeah.
And they call themselves,
yeah.
what did
Mosaic?
You just say?
Mosaic.
Mosaic Conference, yeah. right, or Conference of...
And it's one of the things that tickles me reading some of the... Most of the Mennonite authors, some of them don't, or some of the histories, are very mealy-mouthed about the Revolution. And about how, you know, that most of the Mennonites supported it, which they did not
uh-huh.
at all, period.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so it's interesting to read. Some of them will kind of mealy-mouth around it and claim they supported it. Then others will be more on the other side. Well, no, they kind of went along with it, but they didn't like it.
Yeah, yeah.
And why
yeah,
they didn't like it.
Yeah. By the way, just it's only been 2 days ago or so, I got to talk with... Chester and Sarah Jane Wanger's granddaughter, Regina. Well, she's married now, but she was Regina Wanger, and she's done some graduate work on the Mennonites and their response. Mennonites in Virginia and their response to the Civil War. I think she's pretty well versed in that field, not the Revolutionary War, but the Civil War.
Well, I'm pretty sure most of the Mennonites in the Civil War supported the North because they came from there and they were anti-slave.
But there were a few who had been in Virginia long enough. There was a big farmer down in Augusta County. He sent his sons to the Confederate Army. Yeah,
I've got his diary.
Oh, really? Yeah, I forget
There's
the guy.
There's a church in Waynesboro. Was named after his family. Was named after his family.
Okay.
Mennonite Church, and it's extinct now. The church is still there.
Oh yeah, Is this the one they used to hold a singing there or something? Do you?
No, that's a different one.
Okay. Well, anyway, I remember reading about this guy who he was not a sympathizer with the North. I mean, particularly mm-hmm. after they came and you know burned all his crops and. Stole his cattle and all of that.
But he later was a bishop, and it was interesting. He served as a bishop in the Virginia Conference at some of the same conference meetings as A.D. Wanger Sr. and some of those old guys whose names I still remember.
Yeah, interesting.
But he, in the very last part of the war, he lost one of his sons in the Battle of Petersburg. Or actually, they were retreating from Petersburg to Appomattox, and it was on that march he was killed. In the diary, it talks about going down and retrieving his body and taking it back.
Since we're on this subject, are you still recording? I don't know. Has nothing to do with Mount Pleasanter. But so my son Jesse and his wife Anna now own the bed and breakfast that her parents had owned. And it is, so there are numbers of cottages on this campus now. But the main building is vintage 1700s.
Mm.
And it was used as a kind of a refuge shelter slash hospital during the Civil War.
Mm.
Yeah, they call it the Manor House. So you can ask Jesse.
Where is the bed and breakfast?
It's Garber's. Do you know where Garber's Church Road? And it's right on the western edge of Harrisonburg.
Mm,
so
okay.
It's actually in the city of Harrisonburg, but you go 200 more yards and you're in Rockingham County. Mm-hmm. You know where the Weaver's Church is?
Does roughly.
So, I mean, you can almost see Weaver's Church from this property.
Hmm.
Yeah, so anyway.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of it and I did see when they posted about.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah, so I would love to go to it sometime. By the
yeah.
side of the road, right?
Yeah, so yeah, cool. Well, check it out.
In your book. I mean, in your book.
Yeah.
Because we do have to.
I don't know, you know, how pricey they are.
Supporting family, supporting Caleb, friends, and that's what we'd like to do. So
Caleb, when I stay there, he gives up his bed, which I appreciate. But
he's going to be a big boy. He's tall now. I think I saw a picture of him. How old is he?
He's 16.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's 6'3", I guess, or
oh my gosh.
Something like that. Yeah.
He's a birdie.
Yeah.
Well, both of his
yeah,
parents
you know, his
are
dad's 6'5", right? So, but yeah, he's a great, great kid. He's a real, real gentleman. He got some good Fitzgerald blood in there, too. I mean, the Fitzgeralds are very, you know, proper and polite. So, he did get some good training there.
How did you meet Rose?
EMC. So she was a year and a half younger than me and entered the class behind me. So, you know, it was in beginning of my sophomore year that I met this girl that, well, I was one of the few kids who, you know, my farm background, I got up early and went to breakfast before going to class. Most students drag themselves out of bed just in time to get to class and didn't eat breakfast. So Rose was working in the kitchen. She was just a card. She'd whack, I mean, I could fry pancakes, but she'd whack the pancakes down like that, you know, rather than letting them raise up for whatever reason. But anyway, we learned to know each other a little bit, and then we sort of hung with the same crowd for a while. For a long time, it was a good relationship, but just kind of platonic, you know, we were friends. She probably just got tired of me, but we broke up just a little before my end of my sophomore year, and then I came back down here and one of the worst years of my life, but you know, I worked for my dad and stayed out of school that year. Anyway, we got together again when I went back.
Oh, so y'all were apart for a whole year.
Yeah. I was pretty dumb.
I mean, we all are at that age.
Well, I mean, I thought for a while I could be just fine just being single, and I didn't need a companion in my life and all that. Hey, I'm still being recorded, huh? Oh, man. Yeah. Well, speaking of which, last week, like no other, I just saw person after person. I think it had a lot to do with, you know, a lot of folks coming to Sandbridge, and, you know, somehow they make their way over to Burgess. But this guy walks in the door, I would never have recognized him. And he said, "Hey, Harold." He said, "Remember, they used to say we looked alike." Well, it's true. It was later when he introduced himself. It was Dennis Showalter. We both entered EMC in 1969, fall of 1969. Both had dark hair, were about the same height. Our faces were kind of looked somewhat similar. Yeah, I even got the yearbook out, and my sons agreed with me that, you know, we looked a little alike. But he was down to Sandbridge, and he and his wife Sharon came by for a little visit. It was nice to catch up. I honestly had not seen him for a long, long time.
That's one of the benefits you have in that store that I've thought about before. I said, you get to see so many people there.
That is true.
And
that's
are
true.
A fixture in the community now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is true. The downside is that...
you get to see so many
people. Well, I was going to say, and don't have time to talk to them. Because, you know, then the rest of the staff say, hey, we have customers to wait on here. Or either, if they're too young, they just follow my example and they figure, well...
If he can do it. Forget how stupid youngsters are because they just don't know yet. I shouldn't say stupid, unlearned.
Yeah.
When I was about 13, 12, Mary Wanger had an egg route and she had, I don't know, an operation or something, needed some help on Saturdays. And I'd go with her and, you know, I'd take all the apartments with the stairs or different ones she'd do. You take these and I'd go up and I'd have the money. And sometimes these little ladies would like to talk, and I'd stand in the doorway, and I'd talk for 10, 15 minutes.
And Mary would be sitting there waiting.
And never say a word.
Yeah.
At lunch, she'd drop me off at Master's Drugstore on Collie Avenue and Princess Anne Road. I didn't know, I didn't even think, because I never had a job. I never had to buy anything myself, so I'd reach in my pocket and get all this change I was carrying that was her money, and I'd buy my lunch and a milkshake and a couple of comic books. I didn't say anything to her because I just assumed, you know,
yeah,
it was that age that other people buy stuff for you. You don't have any money. And it wasn't until years later I thought, did she not count her money? Did you think I was a thief? I just didn't know any better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting you mentioned that because I just, you know, I lived on Wanger Road for the first 4 years of my life.
Oh, and then the house back in the cul-de-sac there.
Great grandpa's house, right, where Elsa lives now. Different house, but same piece of ground. And man, I must have been a wanderer. I mean, I think I just, you know, I think my mom was probably busy with my very ill little brother or whatever. And I wander over and watch Mary candle eggs and, you know, package the eggs. Melvin and Homer always like to talk to me or, you know, and tease me a little bit. And Roberta used to say that I would come over, is it all right, do I come in? And one day I just decided to take off through the wheat field and go over to my friends Jerry and Daryl Miller, you know, on Maxwell, and visit them. And Leona knew when she saw me, I'm 3 or 4 years old. And I wandered over through the field. She just loaded me up in the car and took me back home. Dad gave me a spanking when he anyway, but I can't you see me just kind of wandering around the neighborhood?
If nobody tells you not to, assume it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. And not I'm not accompanied by anybody. Yeah. I just kind of come wandering in.
Well, the Wanger Farm was... always welcoming to youngsters.
That's true. That's true.
Because even my cousin Stanley, who's 10 years older than me, I think, lived with Grandpa and Grandma Buckwalter for a while when he was six or seven.
Oh, I didn't know that.
For about 3 years there when he was 6, 7, or 8. And he would spend a lot of time over on the Wanger Farm.
Okay.
You know, Herbert was still preteen.
Okay.
Just a little bit older than Stanley. So.
Yeah. You know, I learned to know Stanley at Warwick River.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know who I'm talking about. Okay.
Yeah, I do know who you're talking about, but I didn't realize that he had, actually I didn't realize he had lived with, over in Ventris, but I knew he was related, you know, I knew the connection.
Granddaddy, I guess, was living in West Virginia, and Grandma was living with her parents. So when Betta Lee took off or whatever she was doing with, Stanley stayed with his grandma, who was staying with her parents, so that's why he was there.
Okay, wow, wow. So who was, yes, I saw at your mother's, well, at the time of your mother's passing, was it Ginger Hart, formerly Harsh, she stopped in at the store.
Did
we
she?
Chatted a little bit. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of neat. Of course, I can't say that I knew her well, but I often heard Gary talk about her or some of the other Keffers, you know. I guess, would she be about our age or something like
that? She's probably 70 now. Yeah, about 70. Yeah, she was always a favorite cousin.
Yeah, that's neat. Got some of my cousins wandering around Europe right now.
Really?
This would be like Sharon Teague, Vincent, and her sister Carol Teague, mm-hmm. Schumacher. They're in Czechoslovakia or something, the last I knew, but all retired now. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes, it would.
Yeah.
Forget going to Czechoslovakia, you just want to be retired.
Yeah. I'm just aiming for the retirement.
Yeah. Well, did you have, I've probably diverted us considerably. I mean, did you have other questions about the Mount Pleasant thing?
No, that was mainly it. I'm getting from Sam's thing and the effect it had on the church. I want to talk to all kinds of people so I can get a better feel for it and try to do the thing even-handedly.
Yeah.
With an explanation of here's what can happen, or what did happen, actually.
Well, excellent.
In fact, I want to talk to Sam, too. I'd be right out front with him. Sam, I'm going to write this. We're still friends.
Yeah.
And I know Sam well enough and have had enough interaction with him over things good and bad that I don't think it'll affect him whatsoever. It's okay.
Yeah.
He's a unique individual.
Well, he is. My sister-in-law, Elaine Moyer, has been like a advocate, support, encourager for Clementina Shahini. Mm-hmm. And Elaine has made a career of school administration. So I think she's chair of the board for LAC now, I believe. So all of that to say, Elaine and Rose's brother Dave and Sam were all hanging together over there
in
Albania in the last month. Of course, I was seeing Sarah, who works for us, and Bev while their father and husband was in Albania. But, yeah, incidentally, Dave said it was a real spiritual experience for him. Dave's not he's not a mushy kind of guy. Mm-hmm. He's always had deep spirituality, but maybe a little non-conventional too. But I think the whole thing of seeing such a diverse group of people loving each mm-hmm. other and working together was really, you know, there's quite a ministry, for example, to the Roma people or the mm-hmm. Gypsies. And he talked about being with Dini, and Dini stopped, and some Roma guys, which they never work, you know, standing on the street. But boy, when they saw Dini, they hugged him and kissed his hand, and, you know, and they just were because they felt like, you know, the school has done so much for their people. And it was like a real conservative group from North Carolina. I mean, not Mennonite, but they've been somehow become real advocates of school, and they were there setting up athletic equipment for the school, et cetera. Anyway, it just said it was quite an experience.
To see so many people come together.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Different backgrounds and beliefs.
You know, here in the U.S., we're, you know, over the last number of years, we just seems like we've seen churches just pull apart, you know, and Dave has seen that too, but this seemed like real unity, and he was impressed.
Yeah, that seems to have been, you can't have a church without a split. Actually, the Amish went all the way from that 1600 split or separation from the Mennonite, and the next split they didn't have until the 1860s.
Really?
Really. There were no Amish splits. They were the Amish, and that was that.
Wow.
But
yeah.
One of the reasons was because they're very congregational. You know, they don't have conferences.
Yeah,
every
that's
congregation
true.
Stands on its own. I mean, they do have get-togethers to try to keep. But if one church is a little different than this one, if it's not a great difference,
who
cares? Reading some of the reasons for the splits, or it came down to personality.
Mm-hmm.
They can quote all the scripture they want, but it was personality.
Yeah. Well, some people say that the failure of the Amish settlement in which my mom grew up in Moyock,
mm-hmm.
It was congregational, and there was just almost zero support from anywhere else. And it was a pretty mm-hmm. small group to start with, and they just went their own ways. So my grandparents are one of the few Amish that got a divorce.
Oh, speaking of that, in doing some of the research on the Troyer family, it appears that after Vernon Beard was killed, they got back together again because they were living in the same household.
Yeah,
in 1950 census.
This house right at the corner of Centerville and Head of River.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I'd like to stop by there again, just tell the current owners, you know, I used to play in this yard. But anyway, I haven't done that. That's true. Mom often talked about that. I don't know too much of it. I mean, I think I was just really a baby at that time, so I don't really have memories of that part. But so I guess Grandpa Troyer had bought the house, and he was living there with two of his daughters, Mary and Fanny.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how it came to be. Grandma didn't have a place then to live for a while or whatever, had sold the place in Moyock. I'm not quite sure about all of that. But Mom's earnest hope was, oh, they're going to get back together. Well, Grandma bought him out, and so Grandpa heads to Louisa, Virginia, and buys a farm up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so then where my memory kicks in is just Grandma Troyer living alone
mm-hmm.
in that house there on the corner of the Head of River in Centerville. We went to see Grandpa Troyer a couple of times, but I never saw him at that house. That was all in the
because it would have been 51 or so when he
that would make sense. I was
because
just
in 1951 baby. He went to Germany, and I gathered to bring his second wife back because I was able to find the passenger list, I guess, you know, when he arrived and when he left and so forth.
Now, where did you find this information?
On the internet.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, he has three patents in the U.S. Patent Office. The most notable is one that he sold to McCormick Reaper in Chicago, some kind of gadget for the cutter bar of the Reaper. Francis always said that he made got enough royalties on that to buy a new automobile every year. I don't know if that's true or not, but completely accurate, that is.
Pretty inventive fella, anyway.
He certainly was, yeah. That was.
And I had always heard that, or maybe I just thought it, that Vernon Beard was killed during the invasion or during the landing at Normandy, but he actually was killed when the war was almost over. So it was in just the last month or so.
Wow.
They were just doing mopping up stuff. But I couldn't find anything about how it happened. Just that he was injured and they brought him in, and he lasted a little while in the hospital and then died.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Mom used to say she remembered when the officers came and gave the news to Grandma. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was quite a bit younger than she was.
Mom said that he had a brother who was like a peer to her. She said a real fine guy. They hit it off as friends, but...
I think Dina was in her middle 40s, and he was in his early 20s. Or maybe she was in her late 30s. I don't know, but I was on a bit of surprise.
Yeah, really. I better get going a little bit, but while we're on that, I wanted to tell you this one story. So, Dale and Kathy attend West End Assembly of God. up in Richmond. You know, that's been their church for the time they've lived there. So Dale had invited me to this some kind of a pastor's gathering, mission celebration or something there. So Dale and I are sitting with the senior pastor, maybe even founding pastor of West End Assembly of God, joking back and forth, having a good time. So I started, I don't even know how we got on this, but you know, started telling the pastor that, well, you know, my grandfather lived right up here in Louisa County, and he married this German woman. Her name was Margarita. He looks at me, he says, I know her. So many a time she'd stand at the back of the church if she had a prayer request or she had something she wanted to tell the congregation, she wasn't afraid to do it. You know, it's very outspoken. And of all things, so after John Troyer, my grandfather, died, Margarita moved to a retirement facility in Richmond, which wouldn't have been that far away, right? And apparently there were some folks from West End Assembly who visited regularly residents at this home, and I guess they invited her to come to church with them. And at that point, up to that point, Dale had not even been aware of that, but it was a good thing for me to hear that, you know, because I don't know if Grandpa ever had any kind of a spiritual renewal or anything after his, I mean, he definitely had a sense of rejection leaving here. Used to say, you know, I didn't want the divorce, but we got divorced, and then the Amish kicked me out, and the Mennonites wouldn't have me. Anyway, hey, I better let y'all get some rest. I'm here jabbering away.
Enjoying the story.
Thank you for having me.
I enjoyed it. I really appreciate you coming by. And I know I'll have other questions. I'll come and ask.
Do it. You can be one. Catch me in the ice cream.